evening. I would like to welcome you tonight to tonight's very special program with His Excellency Zhou Wenzhong, Ambassador of the People's Republic of China to the United States. I'd also like to welcome the Ambassador's delegation, as well as Ambassador Gao Jiancheng and many other guests from the Chinese Consulate in San Francisco. Thanks to the California Asia Business Council and the Asia Society of Northern California for co-sponsoring tonight's event. My name is Peter Robertson. I'm Chairman of the World Affairs Council's Board of Trustees, and I'll be your moderator for this evening. World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, you can visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, the Council offers two great ways to stay connected: by listening to our weekly radio shows called It's Your World on Monday evenings on KQED, or by visiting our website for audio and video recordings of all of our past programs. This evening's program is being recorded for It's Your World, and we thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I'd like to announce two upcoming events. On Monday, February the 1st, the Council is honored to host the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General James E. Cartwright, to discuss the ever-changing challenges facing the U.S. Department of Defense. This event will take place at the Marines Memorial Association and will begin at 6 p.m. We're pleased to announce that our annual conference, World Affairs 2010, will take place on March 11th and 12th at the Westin St. Francis in San Francisco. We'll be focusing on innovative leadership in the face of crises and expect to have a spectacular program, including officials from the Obama administration. Please mark your calendars and visit itsyourworld.org to register now for this exciting event. And finally, you'll notice blue question cards have been placed on your chairs. Please write your questions for the ambassador and hand them off to council staff members, and we'll use your questions during the Q&A session in the second half of the program. And finally, we understand that many people have strong views on our topic tonight and appreciate the fact that you've gathered with us to engage in discussion. I will ask our guests as many of your questions as possible during the question and answer period. Please note that no disruptions will be tolerated throughout the event, and anyone who disrupts our discussion tonight will be asked to leave the premises and will be subject to citation or arrest. Having got that behind us, I would like to introduce our distinguished guest. His Excellency Zhou Wenzhong became Ambassador of the People's Republic of China to the United States in April 2005. Previously, he had served in Washington as Minister and Deputy Chief of the Mission of the Chinese Embassy. Ambassador Zhou has also held numerous senior posts in Beijing, including Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs and previously Assistant Minister. He also served as Ambassador to Australia and to Barbados, as well as Consul General of China to Los Angeles and Deputy Consul General to San Francisco. And maybe it's a little bit of a stretch, but we can claim him as a result of this last item as a native son of San Francisco. Here to discuss the significance of strong U.S.-China relations, as well as to offer the Chinese perspective on their growing role in the world, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming His Excellency Ambassador Zhou Wenzhong.
Thank you, Peter, for your very kind introduction. And it gives me great pleasure to be here. So I want to thank the sponsor and the co-sponsors for inviting me to come back and to speak to this prestigious audience. And it always gives me great pleasure to be back in San Francisco, as I worked here many years ago for about 3 years. So as the saying goes, you know, I have left my heart in San Francisco. So I would like to present to you my views on U.S.-China relations, present and future, and also to talk about, you know, some of the, I'll talk about our views on some of the regional and global issues. China and the United States formally established diplomatic ties at the ambassadorial level on January the 1st, 1979. More than 30 years have passed since then. Despite some of the twists and turns in certain periods, the China-U.S. relationship has kept moving forward. Especially in recent years, with the concerted efforts from both sides, the China-U.S. relationship has made significant headway and is now one of the most dynamic and influential bilateral relationships in the world. It has the following features. First, frequent high-level exchanges. The two sides have maintained close contacts at the top level in the past few years. The leaders of our two countries have paid visits to each other. For many times they have met on multilateral occasions, talked over the phone, and exchanged letters. Since President Obama took office, he and President Hu Jintao have had three formal bilateral meetings. They have had four telephone conversations and met each other on a number of occasions. This has enabled our leaders to keep close communication on bilateral relations and the major international and regional issues. The China-U.S. relationship has had a smooth transition with the Obama administration and is moving forward with a good momentum. Last November, President Obama paid a successful visit to China. He and the Chinese leaders discussed in great depth China-U.S. relations in the new circumstances. The leaders also discussed important regional, international, and global issues of shared interest. Broad agreement was reached, which has been captured in the Sino-U.S. joint statement. In it, both sides have pledged to work together to build a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive China-U.S. relationship for the 21st century, and to take concrete actions to steadily build a partnership to address common challenges. As such, it has clearly defined the bilateral relationship in the new situation and set the direction for its future growth. Second, deeper strategic dialogue. The two sides have set up over 60 dialogue and consultation mechanisms. We had with the previous administration the strategic economic dialogue and the strategic dialogue. Both dialogues played an important role in enhancing strategic communication between our two countries in economic and political fields. After the Obama administration came into office, the two sides decided to combine the two into a new mechanism, namely the China-U.S. Strategic and Economic Dialogue. The purpose was to further step up high-level strategic discussions. At the end of last July, the first round of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue took place in Washington, D.C. It was co-chaired by Vice Premier Wang Qishan, State Councilor Dai Bingguo, as special representatives of Chinese President Hu Jintao, and the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the Secretary of Treasury Timothy Geithner as special representatives of President Obama. The two sides had a friendly and candid discussion of issues that were of strategic, long-term, and overarching importance to the growth of the Sino-U.S. relations. The dialogue led to many important agreements and served the purpose of deepening mutual understanding, expanding common ground, reducing differences, enhancing mutual trust, and advancing cooperation. The two sides have agreed to hold the second round of the Strategic Economic Dialogue in the summer of this year in Beijing. Third, dynamic economic and trade relations. China and the United States have benefited a lot from the growing economic relations and trade. Bilateral trade stood at $333.7 billion in 2008, registering an increase of over 130-fold from January to November last year. Affected by the global financial crisis, bilateral trade was down by 13.4% to U.S. dollars, totaling $266.5 billion. However, China and the United States remain each other's second largest trade partner. Between the year 2000 and 2008, overall U.S. commodity exports grew by 60%, while its export to China increased by as much as 341%. Millions of jobs in the United States are closely associated with the China-U.S. trade. In the meantime, cooperation has become more wide-ranging. It now covers such areas as the energy, the environment, macroeconomic, policy, product quality, and food safety, education, science and technology, culture, etc. Fourth, growing people-to-people exchanges and friendship. There are currently 35 pairs of sister states or provinces and 149 pairs of sister cities between China and the United States. In 2008, over 2 million visits were made across the Pacific. Some 90,000 Chinese students and scholars are studying or working in the United States, and 19,000 American students are studying in China. All this has strongly underpinned the overall relations and the cooperation. Another prominent feature in China-U.S. relations is enhanced cooperation on international affairs. China and the United States have more and more converging interests on counter-terrorism, non-proliferation, regional hotspots, transnational crimes, non-traditional security issues, as well as global issues. Such global challenges include international financial crisis, climate change, energy security, disease control and prevention, and disaster relief and reduction. The two countries are working more closely on these fronts. During the three financial summits and the Copenhagen Conference on Climate Change, China and the United States had effective cooperation. The two sides have also kept up communication and coordination on the Korean nuclear issue, the Iranian nuclear issue, Darfur, Myanmar, Pakistan, the Middle East, among other international issues. By doing so, the two countries have made strong contribution to peace, stability, and prosperity in the Asia-Pacific and globally. The China-U.S. relationship is assuming greater strategic and global significance. Ladies and gentlemen, when the Cold War was just over, some people said that relationship between China and the United States was at a crossroads with an uncertain future. Even in recent times, it has been a recurring argument that China and the United States are heading towards confrontation as China continues to emerge. The Chinese leaders have, on many occasions, underscored that China remains a developing country, with its per capita GDP ranking behind the 100th place in the world. There is still a long way to go before it achieves basic modernization and bring prosperity to all its people. Domestically, China will continue to follow the scientific outlook on development with an open and receptive mind, continue with reform and opening up, pursue a more balanced development and a social harmony, and build a moderately prosperous society in an all-round way. We are soberly aware that in this globalized world, countries are more interdependent. China cannot develop in isolation of the world, while the world needs China to achieve enduring prosperity and stability. On the international arena, China will remain a strong force for peace, development, and cooperation, and strive for a peaceful and a better-off world as its foreign policy sets out to achieve. It is committed to peaceful development and a mutually beneficial opening up. It will reach out to all countries on the basis of the five principles of peaceful coexistence and work with people across the world for a harmonious world of lasting peace and a common prosperity. I still recall that when President Nixon visited China in February 1972, he said that we, meaning the United States and China, have at times in the past been enemies. We have differences today. What brings us together is that we have common interests which transcend those differences. For now and a certain period to come, China and the United States do and will continue to share growing common interests and development opportunities in the following aspects. First, safeguarding world peace and stability. We are both permanent members of the UN Security Council. As the largest developing and developed country in the world, respectively, China and the United States shoulder unique responsibilities for maintaining world peace and stability. There is need for us to work more closely on counterterrorism, non-proliferation, the Korean nuclear issue, the Iranian nuclear issue, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Middle East, Darfur, and other hotspots. Second, promoting sustainable development globally. Countries have never been as closely interconnected as they are today in a community of interests. Together contributing to over 30% of world economic growth, China and the United States are two big economies that have significant influence over the stability and the growth of the world economy. The two countries have so far conducted good coordination and cooperation in tackling the international financial crisis and the climate change. There is a lot more that the two countries can do together on energy, the environment, maintaining a free global trading system, and eliminating the North-South gap. Third, building stronger economic and trade relations for mutual benefit and the well-being of the two peoples. Fourth, enhancing friendship and diversity in the world. Both China and the United States are diverse and multi-ethnic countries. The Chinese people need to know more about American people and vice versa. We need more and closer cultural interactions, and we are pleased to see that happening. We also need to maintain our respective cultural uniqueness and diversity in the world by bearing in mind the importance of harmony without sameness and seeking common ground while shelving differences. Ladies and gentlemen, as China-U.S. relationship faces new opportunities to move forward, it is nonetheless confronted with problems that cannot be overlooked, such as Taiwan and trade frictions. The two sides need to handle these issues carefully in order to keep the relations on the right track. In my view, the following principles need to be upheld to ensure the steady development of China-U.S. relations. First, continue to view and handle China-U.S. relations from a strategic height and a long-term perspective. With the rapidly changing and complex international landscape, as we enter the new century, China and the United States, being two great nations, encounter more demanding challenges and shoulder growing common responsibilities. A stable, healthy, and growing China-U.S. relationship is more important than ever before. Both sides will gain from mutually beneficial cooperation and lose from confrontation. The leaders of our two countries have agreed to work together to build a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive China-U.S. relationship for the 21st century. The mission before us is to make concerted efforts to turn this vision into reality and advance the relations in the right direction. Second, continue to expand common interests and a mutually beneficial cooperation. We need to further increase the exchanges and the cooperation on trade, counterterrorism, non-proliferation, law enforcement, military ties, science and technology, education, culture, and youth exchanges, and work more closely on UN-related affairs and the regional and international hotspots such as the Korean nuclear issue, the Iranian nuclear issue. Meanwhile, we must make the pie of common interests bigger and expand cooperation to move to more areas to keep pace with the evolving situation. Particularly, we need to step up dialogue on macroeconomic and financial policies and work together to address issues concerning the financial crisis, climate change, energy, and the environment. This will lead to win-win results for both countries. Third, strictly abide by the principles in the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques. Respect and accommodate each other's core interests. The three joint communiques constitute the political foundation and important guidance for China-U.S. relations. The One China principle lies at the very center of the three documents. History has proved that the key to a healthy China-U.S. relationship is the firm commitment to the three joint communiques in managing issues that touch on each other's core interests, with the questions of Taiwan and Tibet being the most important. The Taiwan question bears on China's sovereignty and the territorial integrity, and is crucial to China's core interests. The cross-strait relations have undergone some positive changes and embarked on the track of peaceful development. We will continue to promote cross-strait dialogue and exchanges. We will sustain the progress in the peaceful development of cross-strait ties on the basis of building mutual trust, shelving disputes, seeking common ground, while putting aside differences and pursuing win-win outcome. That said, no matter how cross-strait situation changes, we will never waver in our commitment to the One China principle and never compromise on our stance against Taiwan independence or One China, One Taiwan. It is our consistent position to oppose U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. We hope the U.S. side could earnestly abide by the principles of the three Sino-US joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues carefully and properly, stop selling arms to Taiwan, and take concrete actions to support peaceful development of cross-strait relations. Fourth, to respect each other and treat each other as equal partners. There is no denying that China and the United States don't always agree with each other due to differences in social system, historical and cultural background, and development level. This is only natural. The key, however, is that both sides should properly handle differences and the problems whenever they occur. It is important to address them on the basis of the principle of mutual respect and equality and in the spirit of consultation on an equal footing and seeking common ground while shelving differences. Ladies and gentlemen, sustained growth of China-US relations in the years to come is a shared aspiration of the two peoples and it will serve the fundamental interests of both countries. We stand ready to work with the U.S. administration and the people in all sectors to build on what we have achieved and to press ahead along the right direction. We will follow up on the agreement that our leaders have reached, further strengthening dialogue, exchange, and cooperation in all fields, respect and accommodate each other's core interests, and steadily advance China-US relations so as to bring greater benefits to the people of our two countries and the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I got a pile of blue cards up here. So it's now time for us to take questions from the audience. But maybe let me get the ball rolling by asking the ambassador to look forward a few years to, let's say, you know, 10 years, 2020, and tell us how he would like U.S. relations, U.S.-China relations to be at that time and what challenges we're going to face to get there. And this is, so what would you like the U.S.-China relations to look like in 2020?
That's a long way from now. I wish I could, foretell what would happen between now and 2020. But I think the direction is very clear. As I said earlier, we believe being the largest developing country and largest developed country, respectively, China and the United States bear a unique responsibility in maintaining peace for the world and in promoting a common development. So if the two countries could continue to work together and make sure that they will move ahead in that direction, and I think the prospects for the relations are good. Good for 2010, good for 2020.
Okay, well, I'm an energy guy, as you know. Yeah. And in your talk there, you mentioned there were several questions here on energy and the environment. And obviously, there's a lot of balancing to do between the need for energy and the need for environmental protection. And so how does China hope to balance these two issues?
As you know, we have already set a number of goals in terms of improving energy efficiency and in terms of reducing the emission of carbon dioxide. And so between the one, and let me explain to you what we have committed ourselves to. Between 2005 and 2010, and the goal is to reduce the per unit GDP energy intensity by 20%. And between 2005 and 2010, and the goal is to reduce the emission of greenhouse gas by 10%. Then talking about the carbon dioxide, the goal we have just said is for China to reduce emission of carbon dioxide by 40 to 45% by 2020 on the basis of the emission level of 2005. So I think China is a very largest is a country with a very large population, and we have just started the industrialization and the modernization process, and so naturally the economy will continue to grow and the emission will continue to increase. But as I said, we have already undertaken, you know, these commitments. And these commitments, you know, are legally binding as far as China is concerned, because the National People's Congress in China, that is China's legislature, will review the progress we have made in fulfilling, accomplishing these goals.
Okay, I told you in the back room that you get a question on Google, but I didn't know there'd be nine of them. So the question I'll read is one of them that I think is typical. Google China was going to move out of the Chinese market, but yesterday news indicated that the plan may change. What is your opinion and stand on this topic?
You know, internet in China is open. And of course, as other countries do, China manages the internet in accordance with its law. And as you know, internet has grown very fast in China. And I think China has the largest number of people who are using internet or who have, who own a blog on a website. And so we welcome foreign, you know, internet companies to operate in China. So I'm glad to hear that, you know, the Google management is saying that they are not going to leave, you know, that they want to stay.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned in your talk, you mentioned Iran, and you mentioned Sudan, and there are questions from the audience on both those. With Iran, the questions really relate to the fact that, you know, the view is that China has some leverage with Iran. And the questioner is asking why China is not willing to use that leverage to slow up what appears to be the development of nuclear capability by Iran, given some of the players in the region that Iran supports.
Actually, I think we share the same goal. That is, we all believe that Iran should not possess nuclear weapons, and Iran should not develop nuclear weapons. And China is one of the P5 plus one. And I think China has voted for, the two resolutions adopted by the Security Council of the United Nations. And but we also believe, sanctions are only the means. We should give more time to diplomacy. And there is still an opportunity for diplomacy to, work its way out. So that's our view. So we hope, I think that Iran, the offer is still on the table, and I think we should encourage and urge Iran to come back to the negotiating table. So that we will be able to negotiate a settlement of that issue.
Maybe right on the back of Iran, North Korea. North Korea remains unstable politically and economically. What is China doing to improve the situation in North Korea?
Bilaterally speaking, China and DPRK have developed very good relations, North Korea is one of our neighbors, and so we have a assistance program for them. So we want the economy there to develop, and we also want their people to improve their welfare, their well-being. Yeah. So I think China will continue to do what we can to help them, yeah, so that you know, they will be able to tide over their current economic difficulties, and so that their people will have a better standard of living.
There's several questions here on freedom of expression in China. And this specific one says, how can China expect to compete in the global market long term without granting its citizens the freedom to assemble, think, create, and debate?
I think, you know, seeing is believing. I really hope you know, friends who have put that question to me would go to China and see for themselves the kind of changes that have taken place at, and which are, and all changes which are taking place in China. You know, the under the Chinese constitution, citizens in China are entitled for, you know, all these rights. So China has, for the first time, included into its constitution the provision that is respect for human rights. So, but of course, you know, all these rights needs to be sort of respected and upheld within the framework of China's constitution. So we should not equal violation of law to disrespect of human rights.
Yeah, I think one of the I think we would all agree that one of the best ways of improving understanding and relations is exchange of students. And there's a couple of questions here on student exchanges. And the question says, in recent years, millions of Chinese students, I guess it's getting to be millions, of Chinese students come to America to study in universities and colleges. What's your opinion on this issue? And I think I would add that equally important is the to get American students to go to study in China. And so what are the opportunities in that regard, and how important is this?
I don't think you know, that many students have come here. You know, I think maybe it's 400,000 since 78, since China has opened up. But it's a big number. Even 400,000, that's quite a big number. And we hope there will be more American students who would want to go to China. And in the joint statement, the U.S. side has set a goal. That is, for the next 5 years, U.S. Is going to send 100,000 students to China. And I think that's very good. And in, at the end of that 5 years, and I hope, you know, we could even overfulfill. I mean, the United States could even overfulfill that plan.
Questions, several questions on international development, and obviously, I would say, just like a lot of large countries, China's needs to import resources from around the world. So the question is, from a political and economic perspective, what does China represent to the developing world, specifically Africa and Latin America, and both the in terms of the opportunity to help in development and obviously in the relationship as it relates to natural resources and the need?
You know, China is a big country with its own resources. But obviously, China also needs to supplement what it has with import of resources from other countries. And I think every country is doing the same thing. China is not an exception. So I think we have undertaken assistance programs of different sizes for countries in Africa, countries in Latin America, and a country in the Caribbean, countries in the South Pacific. And I think, you know, both sides have benefited from this relationship. And I think the kind of business relationship, trade relationship, of economic cooperation between China and the countries in question are mutually beneficial. And I think these countries welcome this kind of relationship because they are pleased with the way they are being treated. And, you know, China used to be subject to, unequal treaties in China's history. So I think we take it as a foundation for our relations with other countries, that is, treat each other as equals.
I guess there's some questions here on the sort of challenges within China on internal infrastructure and the rate of growth, the sustainability of the rate of growth. But this specific one talks about how is China dealing with internal infrastructure, issues of limited water and food supply, how are these issues affecting China's growth plans? And I think the broader question is just the enormous challenge that China faces on developing its infrastructure and maintaining a sustainable way forward internally.
It is true that China is a big country with a large population, and in terms of in per capita terms, in terms of the water supply, in terms of availability of natural resources, it's a smaller in per capita terms, much smaller than. What is the situation with other countries. But on the other hand, production in China has grown quite a bit. For instance, we produce lots of grain. I think we have been able to produce enough food for our own people. Yeah. So China is basically self-sufficient in food supply. And it is true that we do import soybean from you and from other countries. We do import cotton from you and from other countries. But that doesn't mean to say we don't produce enough. I think actually there is sometimes, because of the difference in the varieties which you produce here and we produce in China, so we need to import to make sure that, economically speaking, the companies involved, the importers involved, they would want to use, for instance, our soybean. Produced here, which have a high oil content than soybean produced in China, because most of the soybean produced here products of genetical engineering, so they have a relatively higher oil content than soybeans produced in China. So the farmers in China, they have a lot of complaints about that, because if we buy soybean from you, that means they will have difficulty in selling their soybeans. And if we buy cotton from you, because quality of cotton is better. So, as far as the textile mills, they would like to import cotton from the United States. But then the farmers in China, they have complaints about, the difficulty in selling their own cotton. Still, China, in terms of the trade of farm products between China and the United States, U.S. has very large surplus. Actually, China is buying almost 40% of the soybean exports of the United States. And China imports almost half, and half of the China's import of cotton is cotton produced in the United States. So I think that shows, although you know some domestic communities don't like the sort of the fact that we are buying you know from you, we're buying soybean, we're buying cotton from you, but what happened is you know China is a very big importer of the U.S. cotton and U.S. soybean. So that also shows that the world is increasingly more interdependent, and both sides have benefited from this you know, relationship.
This question came from a Chinese company, a representative of a Chinese company. It says, what are the most important factors a private Chinese company should look at or be concerned of when considering investing in or acquiring companies in the United States?
Private. Yeah, I think...
So what should they consider? How should they go about it?
I can't remember the name of the Chinese company, but one of the automobile company, which is private in China, has acquired Hammer, you know. Of course, the acquisition is yet to be approved. There are other cases involving private Chinese companies. But I must also point out, you know, to come here to make investment is not that easy. Peter, of course, is from Chevron, and Chevron was involved in a case competing with
Sinook.
That's right.
Yeah,
Sinook. Competing with Sinook in acquiring Unocal. Right. Thank you. So there are successful, you know, cases of success. There are also cases of failure. So I think we need to learn. We need to adjust to the usual practice here. But I also hope, you know, there will be in the U.S. would relax somewhat the control. Yeah. I think the best way to reduce the trade deficit is for China to make more investment here. At least that will be one of the ways to reduce the trade deficit, your deficit, yeah, with us.
Okay. This is a simple question. How would the Chinese legal system have dealt with a swindler like Bernie Madoff? And the question goes on, does the U.S. legal system treat white-collar criminal dependents too leniently?
No comment.
Next question.
No comment.
Well, I think the, you know, just to push a little bit harder on the last one, this issue of, you know, what to consider when trying to acquire things in the United States. This question is sort of entitled China bashing. Although the U.S.-China relationships at the government level are good, there's a habit of China bashing amongst the U.S. population and on cable TV. What is China's strategy? China bashing, I mean, criticizing, perhaps even ignorantly criticizing. But what is the Chinese sort of government strategy for trying to deal with the view or the reputation, perhaps, or the understanding of China within the United States, which is part of the issue with the acquisitions, the public?
Yeah. As I said, I think as far as the companies, the Chinese companies are concerned, I think they should do better homework. They should get to know the market better. They should get to know the regulations better. They should try to do it, approach it in the way that is. That is common here. But on the other hand, I also hope U.S. Would do away with some of the remnants of the Cold War mentality. I remember when I was Consul General in Los Angeles, there was a case of Costco buying the old abandoned naval dock. And I think, so that became, a very big sort of debate, very controversial. And some people alleged that the security of the United States would be at stake. And then eventually, Costco gave up. And then I think Costco, years later, Costco acquired a dock in Boston, and which provided, if I remember correctly, several thousand jobs. And so I think, I really hope you would do, because times have changed. The Cold War has become, the past become history. So I really hope you will do away with some of the remnants of the Cold War mentality. I understand the new administration has ordered a review of the export control regime, not just vis-a-vis China, but vis-a-vis the other countries. So I hope they will take a serious look at the export control regime and try to revise it in a way that is to your benefit and also to the to our common interest.
Okay, the question, this is another question about the future and where we're going, but it says as China's economy is increasingly a free market economy, will China support the idea of a democratic society? Or how, maybe in a broader question, how does the free market economy and the, what many people would say is serious capitalism in China, how does that relate to the nature of the Chinese government, and can that evolve into something more like the democracy that we know?
Yeah. First of all, the world is so diverse, and so we think diversity, harmony without sameness. That's the better thing for us to have, because it is the diversity of the world that has made the world so colorful. So that is to say, different countries, because they have different history, different cultural tradition and different historical background. I think they should be allowed to choose and select, the model which is best suited the conditions of the country in question. So I don't believe there is the model which is suitable, which suits everyone. So in other words, different countries should decide what to do with the management of the country in the light of their specific respective conditions. So that's my general view. As far as China is concerned, I think we have found a developed model that suits China. So since 1978, we have embarked upon a road of opening and reform. And while the changes that have taken place in the past 30 years have shown, this is a model that suits China. I'm not saying that it suits other countries, but I think it's best for China. And so in the 30 years, you'll see that on the one hand, we have come to the conclusion that China also needs market. So what we have now is a socialist market economy. On the other hand, we also believe we should develop a socialist democratic system, which would make sure that all citizens will be entitled for all the rights provided in our constitution. So I think if you compare China today with China, say, 30 years ago or 40, 50 years ago, people would conclude that today's China is much more open. It's much more democratic. I think so I think this is, of course, is not the end. We will continue to explore what we should do, what should be improved. And I'm not saying that China is perfect. There are problems. We still need to try to find solutions to all these problems. But what I'm trying to make is that we think, basically speaking, the model for development we have embarked upon suits China.
Okay, a couple of questions and about the China's. One's described as the regional role of China, and one's described as military budget. Let me see if I can connect them. But this question says, what do you see as China's role in the region in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years? So China's obviously a huge influence in the region, Asia today. How do you view China's role in the region in the future? And this one talks about, it says, as one of the fastest growing military budget, how has China been or planned to be engaged in the global community to represent the responsibility that its power entails? So, you know, China's got a large military budget, growing its military. What is its regional role? What is the role of the Chinese military in going forward here?
Yeah. In the region, you know, I think East Asia, Northeast Asia, East Asia, or in the Asia Pacific region, China is a force for peace. China is a force for common development. And you know, I think there are now, we have developed several mechanisms, such as the China plus ASEAN. You know, this is one mechanism. And the other mechanism is China, South Korea, Japan plus ASEAN. And yet another one is China, South Korea, and Japan. So the three mechanisms, you know, leaders and foreign ministers meet regularly, discussing development issues, and other issues. And so I think China will continue to make its contribution to the development of the existing mechanisms. On the other hand, there have been sort of discussion about whether or not in Asia or Asian Pacific region need other mechanisms. China is open. China's attitude is open to the discussion of that. But whatever we may do in Asia or in East Asia or Northeast Asia, I think it should be conducive to the prosperity, common prosperity, and to the maintenance of peace for the region. So that's China, of course, will do whatever we can to make sure that will happen. And as far as China's military budget, I think as compared to the military budget here and Japan and some of the European countries, China's military budget is very small. And China is a large country with a very long border, and China has a vast territorial sea. So I think it's normal for China to increase its defense budget. Because, I think the defense policy is defensive in nature. And China does not pose a threat to anyone. And we, China, is the only country which has announced that China will not be the first to use nuclear weapons to other countries. And China will not use nuclear weapons against any non-nuclear weapon states. So I don't see why, you know, people should be concerned about rather limited budget for defense.
Okay, back to the sort of original question of this whole conference. What is the one most important thing the U.S. can do to improve U.S.-China relations the most? The one most important thing. And the second part is, what does President Obama need to know about China that he doesn't know?
I think he knows a lot about China.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
I think it's a perception. I hope China would be perceived here, you know, by, you know, people, by friends, as a friend. And China would be perceived as a friend, as a partner. And that's very important. Of course, China will continue to work for helping people to develop that perception. But by and by, I think, I'm convinced that people in this country will learn by themselves how China should be perceived. And China, I think, and more people, I think I can, you know, in the last 5 years I've been here, I can tell that more and more people are perceiving China in that way. So I'm very glad about that.
Okay, the last questions are personal questions about career and first of all, can you tell us about your rise within China to your current position, and how does a young person today, ambitious, rise to a high position in government? And then lastly, we better do that one first.
I'm actually at the end of my tour of duty here, so I will soon leave this country and go back to China. And I'm very pleased that I've been associated with U.S.-China relations for most of my diplomatic career. And I'm very, as a witness to